From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Bob Spitz returns this week. Bob Spitz is the author of the definitive biography of the Beatles called The Beatles. He's also written about Bob Dylan and lots of other stuff, including his memoir, The Saucier's Apprentice, One Long Strange Trip Through the Great Cooking Schools of Europe. His latest book is a biography of Julia Child, and it is called Dearie, The Remarkable Life of Julia Child. Bob Spitz, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Gary, always nice to be here.
Well, I loved the book. It was a lot of fun. I really loved your voice in the book, and it seems to me that maybe the Beatles was good preparation for writing this book. You found a way to let Julia Child speak and at the same time, you know, have Bob Spitz tell me the story.
It's true, yeah. I felt really comfortable telling her story, and I really thought that I could do it in my voice. I thought it was important to do it in my voice to let people know that I understood her and I could really convey it to you. And, you know, since you mentioned the Beatles, I really felt when I was writing this book that it was basically the same book. I understood these people completely. They were the same kind of people.
Well, I saw the connection. And, in fact, you mentioned the Beatles pretty quickly in your book, I noticed. The Beatles and Bob Dylan get a mention pretty quick.
Oh, you know, you're right. I didn't even think of that. They do, yeah. The parallels were so close, and I recognized that Julia was a person just like John and Paul who really felt she had to bring something out of herself, even when the country was telling her, look, you know, we might not be ready for this. But she was convinced that she had the goods to deliver, and she was determined to do it no matter what.
Well, maybe readers of your previous books might not see that connection. Let's just follow that up a little bit more. I mean, Julia was really a pioneer in so many areas. I mean, she was a pioneer in cookbooks. She was a pioneer in television and in public television and in the role of women in America. I mean, she was 50 years old before she ever appeared on TV. Do you see her as that in that same kind of revolutionary era that produced the Beatles and Bob Dylan?
Oh, without a doubt. And it was something that really kept me engaged throughout. Here was a woman who, at the age of 40, couldn't so much as boil water. She didn't know how to cook. And at the age of 50, as you said, had never been on television. So it was really interesting to see how a woman of that age, you know, 51 before she got on TV, decided to reinvent herself. I mean, she reinvented herself from the top down. And for me, that was the most interesting part, that and watching how she decided to, not decided, but determined, and in her way did, change the culture.
Well, before we talk more about her, I want to talk a little bit about your process. About your process. That is, when you wrote, when we talked about the Beatles a few years ago, I asked you if, you were telling me how Paul McCartney had kind of opened the door for you to write the book, and I said, so it was an authorized biography, and you said, oh, no, it's not authorized, because, and then you explained to me why it wasn't, but this book is, in fact, an authorized book, yes?
No, it wasn't. Actually, it was done the same way as the Beatles.
Uh-huh.
I had met Julia in 1992. I was in Sicily. I was in Italy writing a series of articles, and she was in Sicily, and she needed... you know, she was 82, and she needed a younger arm to hold on to. She was traveling around. And I got to chat with her. When I decided to write the book, she had already died. But she had urged me through letter and phone call to write the book. But an authorized book means that either Julia or her heirs or her foundation gets the manuscript and kind of controls it. And I never write a book like under those circumstances. So basically what I got was cooperation. Her family cooperated, all her colleagues, the Julia Child Foundation. I had access to all of her archives, her letters, her scrapbooks, her diaries. But in no circumstances did I show the manuscript to anybody to get anyone's approval. That is, for better or worse, all mine.
And you do quote her... a lot. I mean, you know, it's practically you and her telling the story together. I mean, you quote her letters and her diary, and so obviously you had access to all that stuff.
Yes, I did. I had amazing material. She has her archives at Harvard, and when I got up there, there were something like 126 boxes. So I, kind of jumped right into them. And after about 2 months, I realized that I'd only gotten through the first box. So it was a ton of stuff. I mean, there was so much of her life that she had documented so carefully that nobody had ever really plumbed before. So I felt that I could really put everything together as it happened. And also, you know, I had the luxury of traveling with Julia for almost a month. And I ran a tape recorder every day. All we did was eat and talk. So I had about 30, 40 hours of interviews with her. And it was all about her life. You know, she really went into it. And she was kind of a serious person in that regard. So I think I found the side of her that told the story that we wanted to hear.
We're talking with Bob Spitz, and his new book is called Deary: The Remarkable Life of Julia Child, and he's also written the definitive book about the Beatles called The Beatles, which is now available as an e-book, I'm happy to say.
It is, finally, after 5 years.
That's great. And it's a great book. I think everybody now recognizes it as the definitive work. Do you still get people's reactions, letters, and things about the Beatles?
You know, I do, and it's kind of amazing. I still get about 50 emails a day about it.
Wow.
You know, the cult of the Beatles is as strong as ever, and people want to know the inside poop, and I guess I'm the poop master, so, I've kind of relegated that part of my life to talking about the Beatles, which I never get tired of.
Yeah.
And now I am trying to do the same for Julia, which is, you know, equal fun, which is great.
Well, and one of the nice things about Julia Child is that although she's gone off the planet, she still lives on. You can find her programs so easily and watch them. In fact, I've been doing that since I started reading your book. Every night before I go to bed, I watch an episode of her, watch her make beef bourguignon or veal, something or other. And it's so much fun to watch her. And she really was a presence on television.
You know, she was also, Gary, if you just watch her in opposition to what's on the Food Channel and the Food Network and the Cooking Channel, you see how much of a real personality, an honest-to-goodness, dyed-in-the-wool personality she really is, because she was just an ordinary woman. She didn't have, you know, a lot of media training to change that voice of hers, and she didn't have any stylist, and nobody, you know, kind of dyed her hair blonde, and she didn't just become a culinary rock star. She was a person who you wanted to hear talk to you, just like, you know, an old aunt or somebody over the clothesline. And I think that's one of the real magical qualities of Julia.
One of the things about The French Chef, her television program, is that it was a half hour long. There was no sidekick. There's no announcer.
Right.
She talks solidly for half an hour, and of course she's cooking, but she never stops talking.
No, you're right, and she kind of did that because she didn't know what she was doing. You know, it was the dawn of cooking shows on TV. She had no blueprint for it. She had no television training, so they just put her on the air, and she looked right into that camera and talked, and what she said was what came right off the top of her head. She did have a script, I will admit to that, and she did test all those recipes over and over again. But when it came to being on the air, she looked in the camera and she decided to just talk to the person on the other side of it. And I think that's why all of us still gravitate to it, because it's really honest. It's really just ordinary. There's nothing slick about it. It's Julia talking to us. And, you know, it's what changed people like my mother from being a god-awful cook into somebody who could make a decent meal. Sorry, Mom.
I know your mom's a regular listener to From the Bookshelf.
Well, you never know. She's heard this before.
I'm putting the finishing touches on a French cheese tart. It's filled with eggs and cheese and cream. And this is today's show on the French Chef. Welcome to the French Chef. This is Julia Child, and this is the famous quiche Lorraine, a cheese, a tart made out of cream and bacon and eggs and a lovely buttery French pastry crust. This is what we're going to do now, and we're going to do several other kinds of quiches, and I'm going to show you how to make a pastry dough. A quiche, as you noticed, just stands in its own shell. It's not supported by anything else. And a quiche is only a mixture of eggs and cream or milk and a flavoring. That's all there is to it. It's a foolproof mixture and absolutely delicious to eat. You can make them ahead of time. I'm going to put this back into the oven and it just keep it warm until we're ready to eat it. And now we're going to make a pastry crust. And this is what we want to do is to make a tart shell like this, which you cook partially before you put the quiche mixture in and bake. You see, it's just standing by itself, and I'm going to use one of these French rings, which you can buy at French import shops, but I'm also going to use another method so you'll see what we do. Now we're going to measure out, we have to measure out our flour, and I want to speak a little bit about flour, because there's so many different types of flour. All-purpose flour is usually, in most parts of the country, made out of hard wheat.
Now, I want to know a little bit, in your book, your book is half over before Julia Child ever gets to television.
Right.
Because her life, this is the 100th anniversary of her birth this year, and I guess that's the occasion for your book or your publication.
Right, it is, yeah.
Match that. So let's talk a little bit about her early life, which is also fascinating. And I think you really were enjoying telling us the story, not just of her life, but of the world she was born into. You talk a lot about Pasadena and the early days of California.
Right. Well, you know, she was, people always think that Julie's either English because of that voice of hers or kind of, you know, pilgrim stock. And she was a beach girl from California. I mean, she always felt that she was a California girl through and through and loved being in California. I mean, that was her life. But she was a rich girl. Her dad raised her right off Millionaire's Row in Pasadena. And Julia was no more than what she called a social butterfly, which was another word for a debutante, you know, a dilettante, actually. That's the world she grew up in, you know, going to the golf course every day and polo matches and having butlers at home and servants and cooks and maids. And as she was growing up, she always wondered what would become of her. I mean, it was where she had no idea. She didn't want to be a rich girl.
Well, you know, there have been other books about Julia Child and one recent one that kind of implied that she was a spy. Was she a spy exactly?
Well, I mean, you know, she didn't know what she was going to do with herself even after she got out of college. So, thanks to the war, she wound up in Washington D.C. And the people who were hiring Ivy League grads, and Julie was an Ivy League grad, a C student, wound up at the OSS. She was in the same office as Wild Bill Donovan, who ran the OSS. Mm-hmm. Which, of course, was the precursor to the CIA. And the next thing she knew, she found herself in Southeast Asia running what was called the Registry. Now, the Registry gave code names to every spy in Southeast Asia. It knew their movements. It kind of directed their movements and reported back to Donovan. So was Julia a spy? I don't think so, but was she in the spy business? Oh, you bet she was.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Without a doubt, yeah.
Now, and of course, at that time, she wasn't interested in cooking and didn't know anything about cooking. What? Tell us a little about that meal that changed her life.
You know, Julia always referred to it as that lunch in Rouen. That lunch in Rouen. Paul Child was a bureaucrat and got stationed in Paris after the war. So they took a ship to Le Havre from New York. They docked, and he drove her right to Rouen to a restaurant that he had read about in a Michelin guide. And it was just as you saw in Julie and Julia, you know, when Meryl Streep goes into that restaurant and they put a gorgeous piece of Dover sole, nothing else on the plate except molten butter. And Julia puts it in her mouth, and with that bite, her life changes. She changes from Julia McWilliams, this tall, gawky, social butterfly, into Julia Child, who is going to change the way Americans eat and live. That lunch did it, because it was the purity of it, the deliciousness of it. She had never tasted anything like it, and that was it. That did it for her.
And then, of course, she wrote this fabulous book, which in the 11th hour she had to completely rewrite.
Exactly right, yeah. She spent 8 years working on the manuscript for Mastering the Art. It wasn't even called Mastering the Art. They didn't know what to call it. There were like 10 titles, and they were just awful. But the manuscript was like 800 pages long, and Houghton Mifflin was the publisher at the time. And they got it, and they thought it was kind of brilliant, but they said American housewives aren't up to the challenge. They felt that, excuse me, they said American homemakers. Nobody ever uttered the word housewife.
No.
No, it was like taboo, you know, it was politically incorrect. But, boy, were they wrong, because American homemakers were waiting for this challenge. They were tired of, you know, making casseroles with Campbell's soup, condensed soups, and defrosting frozen vegetables. That was the norm at the time. And Julia brought something different. So anyway, Houghton Mifflin rejected the book, and after 8 years, she was kind of bereft. She thought nothing was ever going to happen with it until she was rescued.
And so then the book that she eventually published that we all now have in our kitchen, that's a much smaller book than the book that she wrote originally.
Smaller, but 2 volumes. And, you know, I wish I could pull that off once in a while.
Do you think the publishers were right to recommend that she make it smaller?
I think they were, because I think American homemakers were daunted by something that would have weighed in at 1,000 pages. And in another respect, I don't know if you've ever cooked from Mastering the Art, but it's not an easy book. You know, it is a book that does, in fact, teach American homemakers how to make French food, but you have to be a pretty adept cook and have a lot of experience to work your way through it.
As I was reading your book, I was picturing Bob Spitz cooking all these dishes also, going through the experience. Did you do a lot of cooking in preparation for writing this book?
You know, I did, and I think I guess The Sausage's Apprentice, my previous book, really put me in the mood for it. You know, I went off and learned how to cook. And then I realized I had to work my way through Julia's book. And I made the mistake of reading Julia and Julia, you know, because she just barreled her way through it and was overwhelmed. But I luckily had a couple years, and I did. I as I was writing this book, I would cook every night for my family. And, you know, they were completely charmed by it. But I got a very good sense of Julia as I cooked through that book. I really came to understand who she was in many different ways and the complexities of her life.
Well, in that way, it's not just a cookbook, and it's not just recipes. I mean, she is present in that book.
Oh, she's so present in that book, Gary. She, you know, she didn't just test a recipe. Julia would write a recipe 50 times. Take, for instance, you know, roast chicken, which she considered the essential meal for anybody. She thought if you could master roast chicken, you could just put a great dish on it, on the table. But Julia would cook a roast chicken, she would cook every kind of chicken. She would cook a hen, a capon, a roaster, you know, 10 different kinds of chicken. Then she would cook them at different temperatures. Then she would cook them trussed or untrussed, or stuffed or unstuffed. Then when she was all done with that, she would cook them in an electric oven to see if that was the difference. So, you know, you hear Julia doing this, and you see her doing it through the book, and you kind of can picture her in that kitchen. You know, in Julia and Julia, when she goes into the kitchen and she chops, you know, 35 onions to learn how to chop an onion perfectly, and Stanley Tucci comes in, and, you know, he's kind of blinded by this pile of onions. He can't even see straight. That's Julia, you know, and she's ever-present, as you said, in that book. That's how she prepared it.
Well, you know, I would say to readers, potential readers of Bob Spitz's new book, Dearie, The Remarkable Life of Julia Child, if you're dieting, you probably don't want to read this book because you are going to be very hungry. And
you know what? I'm going to stop you right there, and I'm going to take objection with what you're saying.
Okay.
Hungry, yes, but no worry about dieting. You know, Julia cooked with tons of butter, tons. And people always worried about that. How can we, you know, live in an American kind of lifestyle and lose weight and look good like Michelle Obama would like us to if we're using all that butter? And, you know, Julia would always quip, well, if you're worried about butter, just replace it with cream. But but Julia always cooked small portions of everything, and she believed that if you ate in moderation, you could eat whatever you want. You could have the butter, you could have the cream, you could have dessert, you could drink some wine with your dinner. And, you know, she was kind of a living testimony to it because she lived until she was almost 92, and she ate what she wanted, and she was in pretty good shape.
You know, things have really changed in the world of food since Julia Child came back to America after her 8 years or so in Europe. I mean, she was shocked when she got here and found frozen TV dinners, and the chickens that she went to get at the grocery store had been frozen and trucked across the country before she got to them, so they weren't as fresh and tasty as the chickens she was used to in France.
Right, exactly.
But also today, you know, everything is frozen and shipped, but also plates themselves are bigger. People eat way more. Servings are huge now.
Yeah, you know, I don't know how Julia would have approached that. The portions in Mastering the Art, and in fact all of Julia's cookbooks, are pretty moderate. I mean, you know, it's enough to have a nice dinner, but not walk away from the table feeling stuffed. And I think that was always her formula for a really good meal. I think this country has really gone to a different place at the dinner table, and it's one of the reasons so many people have a weight problem and there's so much diabetes in the world. You can still eat these fantastic meals and not worry about your weight if you just put things in perspective. And when I went, although I will tell you it's funny, when I traveled through Sicily with her, I kept saying to her, Julia, how do you stay so trim? You know, we're eating three meals a day, and these are killing me, and yet you kind of, you know, you look good. And she said, well, you know, I have this routine. And she made a big show of it. She took her plate, and she drew a line down the middle, and she said, I only eat half. And then she ate the first half, and when she was done with that, she ate the second half as well. So who's to say? I can't figure it out at all.
That's funny. And she was also, you know, kind of appalled to find that Americans don't drink wine and didn't know how to use wine and didn't have wine in their house and so forth.
True. You know, it's funny. After her first couple shows, she would always finish by sitting at the dinner table with the dinner that she just made in front of her. And she would pour herself a glass of wine, and she would look into the camera, have a sip of wine, and dive into her dinner. Well, you know, rumors circulated everywhere that Julia was a drunk. And the reason that those rumors circulated like that was because Americans didn't drink wine with dinner. Nobody did in those days. And it was so routine for her in France, and she wanted to bring that to her audiences. She wanted to bring it to the rest of the country. And really, the wine industry grew up in the years right after Julia went on the air with the French chef, because she talked about it, she drank it, she let people see it was okay. But still, wherever I've been, people always say to me, so Julia was a drunk, right? And I go, no, she had a glass of wine with dinner, that was it. They also think she dropped things on the floor, and that is a complete myth. Julia never dropped things, even on the shows. She never dropped things on the floor. I don't know where people got that from, but they like to think that she was kind of clumsy like they are. And I think that Julia enjoyed that as well.
And I guess the Dan Aykroyd sketch on Saturday Night Live must have made an impact on people.
And on Julia, of all people. You know, it's really funny. I had a good time talking with Dan about this. And he said in all these years, nobody had really asked him about that skit. He loved doing it, and I told him that Julia had a copy of it. She didn't like parodies, because people who did parodies, they always went for the voice, and Julia didn't think her voice was funny in any way. So, it was odd, but, she loved Dan's, skit, because it was dark, and Julia had a wacky dark streak. And she showed it to everybody who came to her house. She had this video of it. And then when she was done, she would reenact it. She would fall over the counter, and then she would go, save the liver! And she would crack up afterwards. She thought it was great. And Aykroyd had never heard that before, and told me the really interesting thing is that skit was written by Senator Al Franken. He was the guy who was under the table pumping the blood the whole time.
Well, that kind of segues into politics, and Julia Child was a very political person.
Oh, you bet she was. She wasn't early on, but Paul kind of instilled it in her, and her father helped a little, too. Her father was ultra-conservative, and Paul, whom she married, her father considered the handmaid of the devil, because he was sophisticated, he spoke French, he was an intellectual, and even worse, he was a liberal Democrat. And Julia soon adopted Paul's politics. And that set her apart from her entire family. I mean, her father really never had much to do with her again, never recognized her success. It was all because of her politics. And Julia let people know how she felt. She was never intimidated. She was one of the few celebrities who didn't worry about expressing herself politically. And for some reason, her fans, whether they were ultra-conservative or ultra-liberal, forgave her and let her be who she wanted to be. It was really quite charming.
Well, the book is called Dearie, The Remarkable Life of Julia Child, and it's a remarkable book, and the author is Bob Spitz. Bob, thank you so much for spending some time with us once again on From the Bookshelf, and I hope you'll come back and talk some more about Julia Child when this book comes out in paperback. What do you say?
Gary, it's always fun to be here. Thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see me again next time. In the meantime, check out our podcast page. It's www.fromthebookshelf.com. I want to thank my guest, Bob Spitz, his latest book, Dearie, The Remarkable Life of Julia Child. Production assistance on From the Bookshelf is provided by Francis Venegas. Thanks, Francis. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.